we're all here hoping for different things, but there are some areas of common ground. Some of you are hoping for some more knowledge, some more know-how, some more information. Some of you are hoping perhaps to tune up on skills for reaching out, for improving those conversations in the tower block or your neighbours around you. Others of us are looking for a bit of vision, some fresh ideas, some inputs. Others of us are looking for actually some friendship, some networking, some perhaps to feel less alone doing this work of evangelism. So we're each coming with different hopes here. I've got some material prepared to help us think through the questions of worldview. The presupposition here, that the sort of starting point is that in the same way that Peter Williams and others were making the point this morning, Jesus responds to different people in different ways. He doesn't have two conversations identical. And he takes into account where somebody's coming from. God looks at where we are. He looks at where we're coming from, what our questions are, what our needs are. And he does respond in an individual way to us as well as a general way. So that's why we're starting with worldview. There are other bits that fit around this. Hopefully, we'll get into that now. We'll start with the question, what is a worldview? Worldviews are all around us. They're under the way that we see the world. They shape our realities. Bernard Williams said, we're all under the influence of thinkers that we don't read. We're all influenced by people we don't actually read. Their books and their ideas trickle down through music, through the arts, through things people say, through other intermediaries. Ludwig Wittgenstein talks about a layer of belief. He was a German philosopher within the Anglo-American analytic tradition of philosophy. He said that there are these webs or scaffoldings of belief that shape the way we see reality, the way that we perceive each other. So I'm going to start and I'm going to try and deal with this in three parts. The first part we'll look at, what does the Bible say about the idea of worldview? The second part we'll look at, what is a worldview? And the third part we'll look at how we can engage with worldviews, how we can have conversations that are meaningful with people about their underlying ways of seeing the world. So first of all, how do we see the concept of worldview occurring in Scripture? So we see, as I've started to say, God engages with people. He engages with the world of the listener. He knows people's names. He engages individually with people. He asks people to recognize him personally. The personal God starts with personal relationship quite often and offers personal relationship. Now, we see examples of Jesus being aware of how people are looking at him and how people are perceiving him. And sometimes he'll go into a story rather than confronting them directly. He'll use a parable. He'll use an illustration. He'll ask a question. Could you give me a drink? He says to the Samaritan woman in John 4. So Jesus seems to be navigating perhaps a resistant space in people or layer in people. He seems to be navigating, trying to find a way through that grid that's perhaps blocking sometimes them hearing him if he was to speak to them directly. The story that we were looking at this morning, the Good Samaritan, he actually starts the encounter. The man comes up to him and asks him a question. What must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus responds by saying to him, how do you read the law? How do you understand the law? Pushes him back to his perceptions and his understandings of reality. And then Jesus goes back again and tells him the story. And so Jesus is at least having two attempts to get round the man's defenses, round his perceptions. That isn't to say that God is a manipulator, or that Jesus is manipulating people, somehow sort of getting round the back and sort of messing with their heartstrings so that they want to believe in him, even if their minds tell him he's not true, he's not real. I think God appeals to us with truth, through the mind, through the heart, through reality. I do also think that we can see examples of God accommodating revelation, accommodating and engaging his revelation to us scripturally through John's prologue. So you have the illustration or the kind of conceptual connection points in the culture around, both with the Jews and the Hebrew people. He's using and making heavy use of the idea of God being light and the light being shining in the darkness. This is a concept that would be very familiar to the Jewish mind. It is a contextualization for the Hebrew people and the Hebrew mind in many ways, because it comes from that world and will speak to that world. But it's also there the use of logos, which will be relevant to various types of Greek thinkers, Epicureans and Stoics and others. So that provides another cultural accommodation, another way of getting into their world. And then I think we see preaching in the early church having numerous examples of engaging with where people are. Here are just a few starting points of the main addresses in the book of Acts. So Acts, as we know, is like a relay race. Peter starts off and then Paul finishes off. And in the beginning stage of this, the main audiences are Jewish Hebrew people. And the starting point is the Jewish scriptures with such people. Paul will go to the synagogue and he'll reason and prove from the scriptures that Jesus is the promised Messiah, starting with their worldview, starting with their perspective. And then as he starts to realize, as the penny starts to drop for Paul, that he's the apostle to the Gentiles, starts to see more Gentile believers coming to faith, and he starts engaging with that world in a much deeper way through Acts 14 and 15, 16, 17. We then see Paul adjusting his starting point to the Gentile mind. He begins to start with their culture. And instead of starting with the scriptures, he starts with the altar to the unknown God. He starts by quoting Epimenides, in him we live and move and have our being, and Aratus, we are his offspring. He starts, there are also another possible 8 or 9 different connections to Greek thought within the Acts 17 speech. So we see so many different connections and attempts to get inside the world of the hearer, the listener. If you think about the conversations in your life that you've felt most engaged by, that you felt most taken seriously, they will have strongly a dimension of that person really listening to you and figuring out and finding out where you are and what you need to find out and what you're asking. So what does the Bible say about the idea of worldview? We see various authoritative scriptural figures like Jesus, Paul, Peter, engaging with the world of the listener. Examples might be Jesus's use of worldview and questions. Jesus' use of questions also indicates an awareness of a hidden layer of human thinking. Jesus asks something like 290 unique questions. And these questions sort of get underneath the surface, don't they, and open things up. So let's now move to talking about what a worldview is and how we can understand a worldview. What's a worldview? We've all got this lens that we look at the reality through. We've all got this lens, and it shapes the way we see. It shapes our perceptions. It shapes what we feel, what we do. It's formed through thinking, but it's also caught and absorbed. In fact, I think we tend to think of worldview as being something that we rationally, consciously decide on the base of arguments, but it's more caught and picked up and absorbed from family, from our background, from social media, than it is from conscious decision making, although that can have an effect on it. There's a story that is told of a guard, and his job is to stop people stealing stuff from the factory at the end of the shift. And at the end of each shift, all the workers from the factory leave and go past him at the gate, and he's sort of making sure they're not taking anything. And a man comes, and he's got a wheelbarrow. I don't know what the Polish for wheelbarrow is, but it's a sort of a funny sort of thing. It's like a sort of a container with a wheel on the front, and you pick it up and you push it, okay? So he's, and it's completely full of sawdust and leftover bits of wood and shavings from the woodwork shops in the factory. And it's dirty, and the man is covered in grease and in sawdust himself. And so the guard searches very carefully through all the stuff in the wheelbarrow. He searches the man, and he can't find anything. But the man has this sort of slight twinkle in his eye, so he searches him quite carefully, but he can't find anything, so he lets him go on his way. The next day, the same man comes past again, dirty wheelbarrow, full of sawdust and wood shavings, and he searches him again. And again, the man sort of grins at him as he walks off, as if somebody, you know, might do as they're getting away with something and want to let you know that they... Anyway, the man walks on. Eventually, the guard, who isn't very good at his job anyway, and he's got a slightly unhappy relationship with his wife, he's told by his boss that he's staying awake too much at night, and something's obviously bothering him. And this is true, because for weeks, the same man with his wheelbarrow and sawdust and wood shavings has been coming past, and the guard has been puzzling about it, and he hasn't been able to get to sleep. So he's been very, very tired. He's been arriving late for work. And his boss has said to him, okay, if you're late one more time, that's it, you're fired. So he goes home, he tells his wife, his wife says, well, I'm not terribly happy either. If you get fired, I'm off as well. So you've got real problems now, buddy. So the guard says, oh no, what am I gonna do? I'm gonna lose my wife, I'm gonna lose my job, and I don't know what this guy's doing as well. I can't figure it out. So the next morning, the guy comes past, and the guard is there on time somehow. He sets his alarm and he gets there, and he gets the man, he takes him a bit to the side, and he says, I need you to tell me whatever it is you're doing. I know you're up to something. I can't get to sleep because I'm so bothered by what you're doing. Please tell me what you're doing. And the guy says, okay, I'll tell you what I'm doing, but you have to let me keep doing it. The guy says, okay, whatever. You can keep doing it. And the guy says, I'll tell you what I'm doing. I'm stealing wheelbarrows. Every day he'd been bringing a completely new wheelbarrow past him with a bit of mud on it. Here's the question I want to ask. Why didn't the guards see it? It was evidence. All the evidence to solve the case was in front of him. But why didn't he solve it? Why didn't he figure it out? Why didn't the penny drop for the guard? Why didn't he work that out? Because there was some layer, some presupposition, some perception in him that was stopping him seeing reality. As human beings, we like to think that we're very clear thinking, that we see things and we respond to them, but we don't always see. And that's also true of people who are investigating and exploring Christian faith. It's true of us in our discipleship, and it's true of people on the journey of faith as well. And we need to take account for how they might, through in many ways, no fault of their own, have absorbed attitudes or perceptions that might make it very, very hard for them to hear the gospel. Our encouragement from Scripture when we take the gospel to people is not just to sort of discharge the obligation of telling them the gospel, not to sort of vomit the gospel all over them and run away. We have to help them understand. We have to help them see. And so we must think about where they're coming from, and we must think about where they may have ideas in their worldview which may block their understanding. So there is a layer of the way we see the world, under our feelings, under our beliefs, this deep kind of core area in the way we view the world and the way we view reality. We might call that worldview. And this is built of all kinds of features. It can have philosophical ideas in there. That's how we tend to think of it. But actually, it has relational elements to it. It has psychological and social and spiritual aspects to it. It contains where we think we will find answers to happiness, as well as all sorts of other questions. The main thing I want to do in this session is to explode this idea of worldview being just a rational concept. It's a very broad thing that encompasses all sorts of different areas of our lives. It may include very everyday questions about how we deal with our own selfishness. How does the guard deal with his problem of setting the alarm? Very everyday questions, practical, pragmatic questions and answers. It may also contain answers to big questions of life and faith, big philosophical questions. What's the nature of reality? Who are we? How do we know reality? Is science going to tell us everything we need to know about the world? Is there right? Is there wrong? What are these things? How can we choose rightly? What should we hope for in the future? What will happen? Now, it must be said as well that sometimes these are articulated. Sometimes these questions become apparent through the language of philosophy, but they're just as present in literature and in music and in social media. If you know how to read the various different languages of the world, and I don't mean just verbal languages, the various different ways that human beings communicate with each other socially, then you can understand the realities that people live in. Now, I want to make a slight distinction here between reality, which is how a philosopher might define what is actually there, and then what I might call reality in inverted commas, which is coming at it more of a kind of anthropological or sociological point of view, which is like the realities that people live in that are real, very real for them. I think we have to take these seriously, but this is the primary meaning I'm talking about when I'm talking about reality. But when I talk about social media realities, I'm talking about these realities. If we're defining reality like this and we're actually gonna engage like this, this will be very, very helpful, but we have to just have our eye on that too. So there will be answers to big questions, big philosophical questions, and some of these will be expressed in the language of philosophy, and some of it will be expressed in the language of Instagram and TikTok and how we articulate notions of what's worth doing in life and what's not worth doing. Some of this is expressed more clearly through choices and actions than it is through talking and writing. James Sayer is a very useful philosopher who has written in this area of worldviews. I really recommend you have a look at his work if you want to go a bit deeper. He wrote a great book called The Universe Next Door, which is on about its 8th or 9th edition now. It's a good book with a chapter on each different major worldview. He's a philosopher, so he's looking at big reality questions. And he names these 7 questions as 7 helpful ways to kind of classify or go through what that reality might be in different people's viewpoints. So essentially here, everybody has a worldview, and everybody's got some sort of answer to these sorts of questions that James Sayer asks. What's prime reality? What's the nature of the reality outside of ourselves? What is a human being? What happens to a person at death? Why is it possible to know anything at all? So how does knowledge function? How is that possible? And the reason that's an interesting question here is because if we'd just evolved to simply survive, then the trustworthiness of our minds might be thrown into question. How do we know what's right and wrong? And what is the meaning of human history? What is the purpose of life? Is there any meaning to it? And as I've said, the realities that people live within may be more shaped by the social world than the philosophical world. There are 3 main worldviews at this level of reality, these 3 different perspectives. There are 3 main stories of reality. So the first of these is naturalism. And this is the worldview of, say, New Atheism or Old Atheism or sort of types of humanism. Under naturalism, the world is just, if you imagine a cardboard box, a box, everything in the world is in the box, and everything in that box can be explained through natural processes and natural properties. It largely would be describable through science or through some sort of type of science, rather than needing revelation or needing somebody outside to reveal anything. And all of the reality that can be known, that can be described, is inside that box. That's naturalism. It's the sort of, there are some technical debates, but it's the philosophical name for atheism, naturalism. The next worldview or perspective is that the universe is one, that there is a reality, but there's also some sort of spiritual reality. Now, that spiritual reality isn't separate from the world in monism. That is the one reality. Christian faith differs, and theism differs, because we think that there is a spiritual reality, a supernatural reality, and a physical reality generally, and these things are separate, and God is distinct from those realities as well. Monism is generally the belief that God is not distinct, or that any divine being or any supernatural being is not distinct and different from the world and from the universe and from the spirituality. It's all one thing. So naturalism is that there is just natural processes and natural properties. Monism is that the idea that there is one reality. Even if we perceive it to have different parts to it, it is all fundamentally one reality. And theism is the belief or the idea that God is real and may or may not be revealing himself or herself or itself in different ways to us. So this is an uncontroversial starting point. This is not something that is in any debate or any kind of major debate. As long as we've made this qualification between reality and reality philosophically, then these underlying realities are the three big stories. And often people will hold a worldview and they will not be aware of fully of these positions, but they still are true. So when people think through their worldviews, some of what we need to do is help them to see, help them to understand where it is that they're probably standing. When we ask, what is love? If we then take each of these three perspectives, naturalism, monism, and theism, naturalism answers the question, what is love, by saying that it's just a device, it's just a something to get us to reproduce, it's just something to get us to replicate our DNA. There isn't a sort of higher spiritual purpose to it. It's not something that ennobles us beyond survival. Our main goal in the hard reality is that we're trying to survive and we're trying to replicate. That is where we get to. Under monism, the idea that there's another being that you can love would be to confuse the position. It would be to not understand monism. Because if you're saying there's another being that you're separate from that you can love, then that actually, that is problematic. Now, this is controversial. This is not something, Russell Brand would disagree with me at this point. He would say, no, all reality is love. But there are some other problems with claiming that. For example, you might say, well, in order to have love, you have to have different people who might have relationship and might be able to love each other. You can't just have love as a free-floating thing. The very nature of love necessitates beings who choose, or persons who choose, to love each other. That, incidentally, is a very interesting way of approaching the third worldview, theism, which is where you're real, you're not an illusion, which you would be in monism, because you're all part of the one, you're not a distinct and different self. Under naturalism, under theism, Christianity, you are a real individual created being with freedoms. And one of the exercises of those freedoms is to choose to love someone or not to choose to love somebody. And the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, that holy family, the infinite personal God, create out of that love, out of their love for each other, and their love overflows. He's a generous, overflowing God. And this is a different way of defining love. And this gives us a pattern and a model. For me, in my life, I avoided relationships for a number of years. I had a series of very long relationships and was living with a couple of girlfriends before I came to faith. And I always was distrustful of this question of how you can find love and how you can stay in love. I thought it was very dangerous and foolhardy and a mistaken endeavor. And it was actually only when I came to faith that I began to understand how to find a way through some of these confusing definitions of love. And it was only then that I began to sort of say, okay, I can go back to relationships and trust myself and trust other people in them. So for people in the monistic viewpoint, like Paulo Coelho, Deepak Chopra, Rhonda Byrne, James Redfield, Russell Brand, and others in the new spirituality, they would have a very different way of grounding love. But in theism, we can ground love in the notion of and the idea of the triune loving God. And this is a very, very powerful, actually a very powerful apologetic, and it's a very powerful connection point when we begin to talk about love in culture with people who are looking for clarity, are looking for answers. I want to talk now about another aspect of worldview and give you a kind of quite a neat way of expressing and talking about it, if I can. Great. So worldviews, I think, are theological. They're profoundly theological. The discussion we just had about the grounding of love indicates that naturalism and monism are expressing ideas about the fundamental nature of reality. An atheist will always, in their worldview, have a God, an idea of a God they don't believe in. And so that, in that sense, naturalism has a theological view of what God is, who doesn't exist, is like. So when Bertrand Russell sort of says to God, why didn't you provide enough evidence of your existence? A famous sort of atheist philosopher said, I would say to God, you know, why didn't you provide more evidence? That is because Russell had an idea of what God was asking for, and that there was a certain relationship that God was asking for, but Russell didn't feel that the evidence was enough for that. Now, that's his view, but that was one point of view. And then we also see that monism has views about God and the spiritual world. So I think here's what I want to say is that we're not starting the conversation about theology. Everybody's already expressing theological views about what God is like, what God might not be like, about, and we can get involved in that conversation with people. We don't have to start that conversation. We just need to know how to uncover it, how to find out the different parts in there, in the way they are interacting with the world and each other, where they're expressing those things. We don't have to get onto the God topic. We need to find where they're already thinking about the God topic. If we can engage with that, we'll engage with where they are. In House, the medical drama, in his worldview, he's a very, very good diagnostic medic. He can diagnose these cases that nobody else can figure out. I feel like I've got a tail that I keep having to sort of... he has to diagnose these cases, and he uses this mantra. Do you remember it? What House's mantra is? His mantra is, everybody lies. And he applies it to everything. It's utterly rigorous that he applies it. And it causes him great success and great pain relationally. Here's him expressing that view. So this is what I would call a core creed. And this is the other aspect of worldview that I want to talk to you about and tell you about. So core creeds in worldviews are base level ideas that we don't always recognize. And it comes back to what you said about phrases that summarize and connect with reality. The way that most people engage with their own worldviews and express and hear other people's worldview is through these sort of phrases. Now, some of them go very, very deep, and that's what I mean by a core creed. A core creed is maybe a belief or an idea that you might repeat to yourself, even unconsciously, maybe hundreds of times per day. I think that in the life of a Christian, it can form a very... It can be a very powerful thing that influences the shape of your discipleship and your growth and your relationship with God, especially if it's not recognized. And I think in the lives of people who are investigating faith, it can also be something that can powerfully open up or provide a connection point. It's a point of extraordinary honesty when you discover somebody's core creed. In psychology, it's in the work of Padetsky, it's called a schema, if you're familiar with that. And one exercise you can do to try to get people to describe or see or identify their underlying core creed is the fill in the blanks exercise, where you say, the world is blank, God is blank, other people are blank, I am blank. And the words you put into those blanks will show you or could reveal to you your underlying perspective. So these are all core creeds that people in sometimes great pain have told me that they struggle with. No regrets, that was told to me by a childhood friend of mine, and it really powerfully affected her life, very, very powerfully, and to some extent still massively does as well. Keep calm and carry on. Could be just a simple thing on a tea towel, but it could also be, for many people, a strength when they experience anxiety or different things. Believe in yourself. That is the mantra of YouTube and social media. 1,000 or 1,000,000 videos will give you that advice. Just believe in yourself. But for many people, that is, they've absorbed that, and that actually, for better or worse, is their outlook and is their summary. Don't choose, you'll miss out. That was told to me by somebody who had twice broken an engagement with a girl. Her father had said that he never wanted to see him again, and if he ever saw him again, he'd attack him. We wouldn't like to hear from him again. And by him opening up and discovering that he was afraid of making commitments because of FOMO, because of fear of missing out, He could then navigate making commitments. They're now married with a couple of kids, so he found a way through. You're a failure, you're hopeless, always expect people to let you down. For me, a really powerful one, shaped in part by going to boarding school when I was 8 years old and not really wanting to be there, and then by a series of difficult experiences during my teenage years, I absorbed the core belief, other people aren't safe. Nobody's safe, and I trusted nobody. So when I was in relationships, I was always savvy and not really fully trusting. I would never really share what I really felt and where I really was, because that gave me a sort of bit of protection, because I didn't trust other people. And although many of us are Christians, committed to Jesus, we can still have these core creeds that can boundary and hold us back from healthy relationships, from healthy growth with God. But this also is true of people who are not yet believers. And if we can go on a journey where we safely discover and bring our core beliefs into conformity with God's scripture, with his truth, then we can actually find freedom. I'm convinced that greater freedom in the Christian life and freedom for non-believers on their journey of faith can be about coming to and living in the truth. So the last thing I want to tell you about is this concept called real as a way of coming at worldview. I'm slightly rushing through my material now because we spent some time getting to know ourselves at the each other at the beginning, but I hope you'll forgive me. So I've come up with a way of conceptualizing worldview that incorporates this and this. And it also, within it, brings in how we're dealing with suffering and pain in our lives. Because I think how we deal with suffering and pain in our lives is one of the most formative things in choosing a worldview and what we settle on for a worldview. And I think it affects how our core creeds form, what gets us through, and I think it's one of the main supportive structures that we use. So I've come up with this conceptualization around this acronym called REAL, and I've been using this for about 10 years, and it's been very helpful in conversations with people. So there are four fundamental questions. What's reality? What's wrong? What's the answer? And what happens if we live with this? So the first question is James Sayer's questions of reality. What is the basic reality that's there? Is it naturalism? Is it monism? Is it theism? Is it something else? What is our view of reality? What are human beings? Are we complex biomechanical machines? Which is what a computer science professor asked me when I asked him if we could ever make computers think. That then led to me going on a journey to become a Christian, because I thought, I don't know the answer to that question, I need to find out. So what is reality? What's the nature of the real? How can we know reality? What are human beings? Then secondly, what's wrong with the world? What's broken? When we see things in the world that aren't right, what do we go to for a kind of explanation? How do we make sense of that? How do we figure that out? What do we turn to? When you watch the news, what do you reflect back on? So my father-in-law said to me, he's not yet a Christian, but he said to me, what's original sin? What is that? What do you believe about that? And we were sitting on Christmas Eve, just having a drink, chatting late at night, waiting to sort of sneak various presents into people's rooms, as you do at Christmas Eve if you've got kids in the house. And I said, well, it's this, turn on the news. And so we turn on the news and we watched for about 10 or 15 minutes. I said, when you see all those stories, what do you think? What's your impression watching all those stories? He said, I think human beings are messed up. I was like, that's kind of the idea of original sin. We're getting close to that now. He's like, okay. And he sort of the penny starts to drop. So, what's the error? What's wrong? And then what's the answer to that? What's the solution to that? And then what does life look like? In terms of solutions, generally they break down into two different categories: help from outside or help myself. And the different perspectives offer different versions of this. And then what does life become? Is life healthy? Is it broad? Is it rich? Or is it actually... Is it reduced? Is it tinny? Is it thin? Is it sort of shallow? Or is it a rich, broad, deep conception of life? Okay, last part is some tips for how we think about and talk about worldview. So we've gone through, we all have a worldview. It's like a lens, a grid we see through. I've given you a couple of illustrations. One would be a lens. The other would be the story of the wheelbarrows and the sawdust and wood shavings. You're free to steal that story. Use it as many times as you like, wherever you like. Our worldviews are formed in different ways through our, it can be absorbed, can be chosen. A worldview can stop us hearing things, can be a barrier. It can help us to answer everyday questions. We carry answers in it. We carry philosophical answers in it. There are three main types of worldview: naturalism, monism, and theism. And then we have the idea of core creeds and worldviews and how there are these phrases or ideas deep in the substance and structure of the way we see the world that are sometimes these phrases or mantras that we say, and that if we really want to engage with worldview, we may need to start talking about those things gently and carefully. And then I've given you my real model of thinking about and conceptualizing worldview. Things to avoid doing when we're talking about worldview, when we're engaging with worldview, and when we're choosing a worldview. Good reasons to choose a worldview are because it's true, because it works, and because it's good. But so we sometimes find that we choose worldviews for bad reasons. We don't like the alternatives. It's what the culture says we have to believe. We can give tips to people about, you know, just quite commonsensical kind of tips about how to choose a worldview. And this is often what people are looking for. They don't always want a great big confrontational discussion about, is it naturalism? Is it monism? Is it theism? They just sometimes want some tips for how to find their way through thinking through big questions of life and faith. And so you could say things like, look, don't just choose something that makes you feel good. Don't let that be the thing that shapes your worldview. Don't just choose something that everybody else believes. Try to choose what's true. Try to find out what's good and real and true and healthy. Choose that. So good reasons to choose a worldview are because it's true, it's good, and it works. And the more conversational we can do this, the better. So this is sort of just a visual for different ways that we can think through it's true. Does it make sense? Does it tell it like it is? Is it livable? Does it actually help us? Final thought is this. As you engage with people's ideas and worldviews, remember that Christian faith is not primarily a worldview. It's a relationship. It's a relationship, a living relationship with Jesus. The worldview of Christianity is rich and satisfying and coherent and robust and is evidenced. It's highly rational, and it can be something that our minds can totally fly around and we can ask questions. And many of those questions have significant and powerful answers within the Christian worldview. But Christian faith is not a worldview. It's not a system of ideas or thinking. It's a living friendship with God. That's what we're offering. We're not offering people a change of belief. We're offering people living relationship with Jesus. And so as evangelists, wherever we're involved in evangelism and thinking about worldview, we want to be making sure that we're emphasizing to people, look, this is not about just ideas or moral behavior or improvement or just kind of clarity about God. That's not primarily what I'm talking to you about. I want to talk to you about the God who made himself known and is relationally interested in you and has become my friend in my life. So we're offering relationship, not just ideas. That sometimes means we have to cross what Rico Tice calls the pain line of kind of just saying, look, I need forgiveness in my life. I think we all do. What do you think about that? Are you interested in relationship with God? We have to sometimes get a little bit more personal and ask people questions about what do you turn to? Do you think you need forgiveness? Who do you think Jesus is? Don't be afraid to sort of towards the, you know, as the conversation is at the right point, to just slightly sort of be a bit of challenge about actually, have you ever considered that God is not just an idea? He's a person who wants to know you. What would God have to do to show you that he was a person? Are you open to that? Can we pray for that? I love praying for people in these conversations.